Bible reading today is in Job, yet again, probably two of the most difficult chapters in the whole book of Job as we look through it, in terms of there not being anything very bright or cheerful about them. And so I've entitled the message later on that struggles are normal. And I want to read one half of those two chapters, to read part of chapter 21 from verse 1 through to 16. When Job begins his reply, begins to express how he feels about the situation confronting him and the world. So that's Job chapter 21, reading at verse 1. Then Job replied, "Listen carefully to my words. Let this be the consolation you give me. Bear with me while I speak, and after I've spoken, mock on. Is my complaint directed to man? Why should I not be impatient? Look at me and be astonished. Clap your hand over your mouth. When I think about this, I'm terrified. Trembling seizes my body. Why do the wicked live on, growing old and increasing in power? They see their children established around them, their offspring before their eyes. Their homes are safe and free from fear. The rod of God is not upon them. Their bulls never fail to breed. Their cows calve and do not miscarry. They send forth their children as a flock. The little ones dance about. They sing to the music of tambourine and harp. They make merry to the sound of the flute. They spend their years in prosperity and go down to the grave in peace. Yet they say to God, 'Leave us alone. We have no desire to know your ways. Who is the Almighty that we should serve him? What would we gain by praying to him?' But their prosperity is not in their own hands. So I stand aloof from the counsel of the wicked." So he's part of that passage we're going to have a look at later, and complicated, difficult, but I believe inspiring as well for us. And we look to God to touch our hearts through his word today. I call today's message, "Struggling is Normal." In the past few sections of this book of Job, we've actually had some very bright moments, some phenomenal statements that Job could express in the middle of the pain and difficulties through which he was going. So last week, as we looked at the previous two chapters, we heard those great words of Job: "I know that my Redeemer lives, and that in the end he will stand upon the earth. And after my skin has been destroyed, yet in my flesh I will see God. I myself will see him with my own eyes, I and not another." And you sense that no matter what's surrounding Job in that situation, there's this high point in the middle of that discussion with Bildad that lifts his spirit, and trust lifts ours as well. But these two chapters, as he takes his round two in the ring with Zophar, very different chapters. There's no comfort for Job now, just Zophar's cool theological statement about how the wicked ultimately suffer. And when Job replies, it just sounds like an elaboration of his reply to Eliphaz four or five chapters back. Job's argument is that lots of wicked people, those who totally and deliberately leave God out of the reckoning of their lives, actually have a very enjoyable way of life. And so he thinks that Zophar's up the creek when Zophar says, you know, ultimately all the wicked will suffer and all the righteous will prosper. So say two chapters, it might sound like a good chance to get home quickly, but chance is a fine thing. In actual fact, as you look at the two chapters, they remind us that life itself and the times of suffering and trial we go through are marked by being tough and tedious and uncomfortable. Struggle is very much part of the norm of life. I guess at a holiday time, we do focus on, wow, I can get away from things and go up to some wonderful place like Port Rush or Port Stewart and enjoy the rain up there and be free from the burdens and struggles and trials of work and home and family and all the rest. But we're aware that that little capsule, that little bubble of holiday is actually the unusual thing, and the norm of life is the hassle and the struggle and the burden that often seems relentless to us. When we go through particularly difficult times like Job was doing, that's even more the case. The norm is a struggle. The rare moments are those bright times when suddenly some truth comes blindingly through the darkness and lifts our spirits for a moment or two. And so I don't want to bypass these chapters. I was tempted, as ever, but I don't want us to, for these chapters, in their darkness, in their struggle, in their pain, actually reflect what God's called us to go through in the course of our journey in life. God hasn't said, put your trust in me and everything will be fine, everything will be rosy, you'll be as happy as Larry from morning to night. He actually says, becoming a Christian, taking on the battles, taking on the struggles, is part of what he's called us to do in this life. So what do we take away from these two chapters? I want to look first of all at the fact that the comforter, this is so far now in chapter 20, the comforter is struggling with compassion. If you get the picture we've looked at through the book, three friends of Job had kind of trademarks about how they looked at life. Eliphaz conversed with Job, basing his words on his own personal experience. So Eliphaz's line was, Job, I've been there, I've seen it, I've looked at life, and here's what I've drawn out of my experience. Bildad's basis, his foundation for argument was the ancient wisdom of all the past wise men and godly people in history. His line was, Job, you can't base anything just on one person's experience or even on one generation's experience. You need to take the wider, broader, deeper picture. Zophar, who's on round two here, his line was, don't go on personal experience, don't trust the wisdom of people, just take the truth, the doctrine, the theology, and that'll keep you on the straight and narrow. So when you read through chapter 20, Zophar's second round words to Job, read it as many times as you like, use as many modern versions as you could possibly get a hold of. I don't think anywhere we get even a glimmer of softness or grace or warmth or compassion. It's pretty cold, hard stuff. Whatever sensibility Zophar once had towards the sufferings of his best mate, Job, it seems to have evaporated. And in a sense, it's worth just stopping, I think, as people today and saying, you know, that's a fact of life sometimes. It can happen. And it should sound alarm bells to every one of us. The very best friend in the world, the most sympathetic listener we ever find in life, the warmest counselor in the world, the most compassionate companion, can grow tired, can grow weary of being compassionate. The truth is, real compassion is actually a very demanding exercise. It stresses every part of our mind, sometimes our body, and certainly our spirit. If you're going to be really compassionate to someone, a real help to them in their worst, darkest times, it's not a dawdle, it's tough going. Everyone who wants to be a true comforter to others needs to monitor themselves every so often. Need to ask, well, come on, Trevor, am I really being as compassionate as I want to be or should be? Or with the passage of time trying to help this poor soul, have I actually got a wee bit cold, a wee bit weary, a wee bit hard-hearted through it all? Good question to keep asking ourselves. Dig a bit deeper into Zophar's words in chapter 20, verses 2 and 3, and I think you'll hear what has replaced his compassion. Remember, he's a guy, along with his friends, who had gone a long journey to be with Job. He'd spent a lot of money, a lot of time, a lot of effort to be with Job. For the whole of the first 7 days, morning, noon, night, 24/7, he'd sat with Job on the rubbish heap where Job was. So it wasn't a man who didn't care. It wasn't a man who had a hard heart and couldn't be bothered. He had been mightily bothered, but it had changed. Time had changed things. And I think now he's finding life a bit more complicated. Let me read to you those verses 2 and 3 of chapter 20. Here's Zophar starting his round 2 conversation. My troubled thoughts prompt me to answer, because I am greatly disturbed. I hear a rebuke that dishonors me, and my understanding inspires me to reply. Now, just imagine you're the suffering Job, and your best friend or one of them starts talking that way to you. You don't feel as though he's caring very much about you. Suddenly, this man who's prepared to sit with you for day and night for 7 days has now become someone who's more interested in himself. You could divide those into his own troubled thoughts in verse 2, his upset ego at the start of verse 3, and then his intellectual pride in the second part of verse 3. Troubled thoughts. I'm going to have to deal with you, Job, because I'm troubled now. He's moved on, just hasn't moved in the right direction. Initially, he saw Job as a troubled man, and him as a man who had it all together, who could give him the right doctrinal answers for the moment. Now he says, my thoughts are troubled. His ego is upset. Very interesting phrase. I hear a rebuke that dishonors me. And this is a man, as we said, whose kind of basic gist in life was say, what's the truth say? What's cold, factual, doctrinal, theological reality say? But suddenly he changed even that tune. And now, I've heard you say something and it dishonors me as I'm all upset, Job. And that intellectual pride, I'm the man with the answers, so I'm going to have to answer you, Job. End of verse 3. In summary, Zophar is perhaps subconsciously, but nonetheless truly, acknowledging that suddenly he's absorbed by his own feelings and not Job's anymore. And of course, we could be really hard on Zophar for doing that, couldn't we? We could give him a bit of stick for shifting his compassion from Job, so now he's just feeling sorry for himself. But again, I think we need to see this as a possible byproduct of genuine compassion. It sometimes happens. Maybe it sounds odd to us, but it's possible to get so caught up with trying to enter into somebody else's suffering, so moved by their pain and their anguish, so troubled by what's troubling them, that it starts to hurt us. And we feel the hurt just as though it was theirs. That's what compassion is like. It's about having a feeling alongside or with somebody else. I think part of what happens with Job's friends is they so entered into his experience at the beginning. They so lived his pain and frustration with him in those early days, so shared his puzzlement and confusion at the start, that now they can't detach themselves from that. And suddenly it's become theirs, and they're the sufferer. And all that Zophar can say is, what's happening to me now, Job? I think we've all been there some kind of level, haven't we? You've sympathetically watched someone enduring great pain. And after a while, you come away from them and you feel exhausted. You feel bewildered. You feel as though you're the one who's suffering. You can't cope with all this. And that, I think, was happening to Zophar and to his mates as well. Or you go on to a funeral, and the actual person who's being buried isn't somebody that you had any particular closeness to. You don't feel as though you're bereaved for them. But their partner or their friend or their parent or their child or their granny was somebody you're very, very close to. As you're sitting in the funeral service, you see the tears running down the face of the person you do care about, and you feel bereaved. You feel sad. The tears are rolling down your eyes in a few minutes. Not for the sake of the person who died, but because you've sympathetically, compassionately entered into the feelings that your friend, relation is going through. I think that's part of what's happening to Zophar and his other friends here. Convinced he's still being helpful, but somehow in reality he was suffering as a consequence of trying to comfort Job as well. And two applications of that for ourselves in practical things. When we ourselves are the carers trying to help other people, we need just to watch our own compassion level. And we got caught into this to such an extent that our focus is off of them and now onto ourselves and the byproduct of their suffering worked out in our lives. Has our compassion level dropped as a result of the emotion we've expended on them? The other application would be to us when we are the sufferer, when we are the Job in life, and we are feeling very sorry for ourselves, feeling very troubled, having a lot of pain, a lot of uncertainty, and then our own Zophar comes on the scene and acts just like Zophar did here, as though theirs is the trouble and theirs is the suffering and theirs is the anxiety rather than us. And we as sufferers need to make some allowances for the Zophar in our life, cut them some slack. All kinds of people come into that category. Having had quite a lot of dental work recently, I'm sure the dentist I go to entered her profession with a desire to show compassion to people whose teeth weren't in 100% state of health. I'm sure that when she started her work, she felt deeply for her patients and tried to enter into, is this too sore for you? Is this a bit nervy for you at the moment? Do you need a bit more anesthetic, etc., etc.? But I think as time has passed, some of that compassion has gone now. So when I was wincing and pulling away from the nerve being touched, I didn't feel always I got the amount of sympathy I could have had from her, let alone from a wife at home. Maybe it's your GP. Your GP entered his practice or her practice, motivated by a sense of vocation, wanting to care for people, taking the Hippocratic Oath, wanting to show the best care they possibly could. But sometimes when they've had a busy day or busy week or busy month and they've had a whole crowd of people in who didn't need their help really at all, they just want a bit of sympathy, sometimes that compassion level drops. The nurse who's taking your third dose of blood this week started off her profession, I believe, in theory at least, motivated by a desire to help, to show compassion, to guide you through the struggles of life and make it as easy as possible. Sometimes the compassion level drops. Simply the amount of people they're looking after, sometimes the time schedules that are upon them, sometimes the financial constraints that are around them, sometimes just the enormous psychological and emotional drain on them. And so when they're taking a third blood test from you, they might not be just as compassionate and understanding as you expected. Or the same might be true of your pastor. Or the same might be true of your family. Or the same might be true of your best friend. The Zophar principle is simply that sometimes the comforter starts to struggle with showing any more compassion to the person who's troubled. And the Zophar in us needs to be aware of that, and the Job in us needs to be aware of the same truth. The comforter is struggling with compassion. Moving to the next chapter, chapter 21, looking at Job's reply, I've called this the sufferer who's struggling with comprehension. Job and Zophar end up in this kind of argy-bargy. Zophar has set out what he believes is the cold truth. Wicked people will ultimately suffer for what they've done. So when you run your eye down through chapter 20, Zophar's line is, evil prosperity is only there for a short time. Verses 5 to 11 of chapter 20. So for our second point, evil pleasure eventually turns sour in the mouth. So he's saying the evil person goes along having a great time, it real tastes brilliant, living life to themselves and without God. But ultimately says, you know, there'll come a time when that turns sour and bitter in their lives and evil doesn't prosper. Zophar again in chapter 20, verses 18 and 19, evil profits will one day have to be returned. We're not quite sure whether that will happen in the banking sector throughout UK or not, but his mentality was, you know, the person might prosper by cutting shortcuts and doing the wrong thing, but one day you'll catch up with them and they'll have to pay it all back again, and all their profits from wickedness will evaporate. Verses 20 to 29 of chapter 20, Zophar, again, evil passions are not lastingly satisfied. You think, as an evil person, without God in your life, doing what's wrong, you're having a grand time, but eventually you realize it's not really satisfying. Job's position in chapter 21 is the opposite. More easily summarized in verses 7 to 13, I know, he says, cheats have prospered. And as we saw in the last chapter, last week, Job has his mentality. Actually, if you look at life, very often the wicked are prospering. He has an interesting new thought in verses 14 and 15 of chapter 21, towards the end of where we were in our reading this morning. He's saying, it's not just people doing wicked stuff, evil stuff, bad stuff, moral and ethical failure that's at stake here. He said, these are people whose attitude to God is abominable. They actually say to God, I don't need you in my life. They say to God, why would I have any interest in praying to you? Keep out of my life, God. That's their attitude. And Job says, you'd imagine that that sort of person, if the wicked always suffer and the righteous always prosper, then that kind of challenge to God wouldn't go unmet. If someone is blatant to God as that and God's for real, then God is going to give them a bit of thunder, lightnings, or whatever happens to be. And yet he says those very people have often been spared and gone right through to their last day on life having a brilliant way of life. And that's kind of two sides of the argument that we saw last week as well. But now I think Job goes one stage further. He's saying it's neither true that the wicked always suffer in this life, nor the wicked always prosper in this life. So Zophar and his friends were saying the wicked will always suffer, and Job, that's why you're suffering. Job's previous argument was, no, the wicked often prosper and the righteous suffer. Now Job is saying, actually, there's truth in both those things. There's wicked people who suffer and there's wicked people who prosper. There are righteous people who suffer and there are righteous people who prosper. There's no overriding law that applies to every circumstance in life. I think that's pretty close to the truth, isn't it? That's pretty much how you and I experience life. What Job does have is this puzzling reality summarized in chapter 21, verses 23 and 24. One person dies who's had a great life and is buried alongside someone who's had a rotten life. Paraphrasing a bit, but that's what Job sees. In life, there doesn't seem any great fairness, doesn't seem an overriding principle that live a godly life and you'll do well, live a wicked life and you do badly, or the other way around. Not overall, not absolute. And then she said, when they die, you get one stuck in the grave who has lived an exemplary life, and the next grave to them, someone who's lived a rotten life, and they both rot at the same pace. That's pretty bleak, isn't it? I think Job has actually reached a stage in his own comprehension where, although he's struggling with that, he's beginning to see there is an overriding picture here. It comes from verse 22. Can anyone teach knowledge to God, since he judges even the highest? He's saying, ultimately, this is about God doing things in his world that are beyond my comprehension. What I want to leave us with, actually, is not that. Although he progresses his argument, and we'll do that further in chapters to come. But I want to turn your thoughts to chapter 21 and verse 6 as we close. Here's what Job says. He starts to work this out. When I think about this, about these things, I'm terrified. Trembling seizes my body. I think Job's reached a point in this whole debate with his friends where he's saying, actually, you know what? There's no comfort for me in my situation, either from your kind of arguments so far or from mine either. I'm not being comforted by this. I'm just left struggling to get a hold of it all. In fact, he's saying, you know what? So far, just having this discussion is making things worse for me. The discussion is not a bad one, and God's people do need to wrestle with it. But I think Job's saying, you know what, Zophar, this is not the time or place for me to have this discussion. Look at verse 2. Again, slightly paraphrasing it. Zophar, the best comfort you can give me just now is to shut up and listen to me for a while. What he's saying is, look, Zophar, I know you mean well. I know you've been compassionate in the past. I know you're struggling to grapple with things just now in your compassion, but I'm struggling too. And the last thing on earth I need is this profound, complicated, philosophical, theological conversation. There's a place for it, but it's not just now. It's not here at this moment in time. Both he and Zophar need to realize this is a situation that is beyond their understanding. Both needed to recognize that coping with the suffering is enough to get on with for the time being. Struggling to work it all out, struggling to answer all the questions, was actually only making things worse for both of them. And you might say, okay, Tara, but what do we do when we're in that kind of situation? The trouble is, comforters, is very often we hear the questions asked, we think, well, they really, really want me to answer the questions. No, they just want us sometimes to listen and then to move on. Because a Christian's response brought to us throughout the whole of Scripture is, what God counsels us to do is just to trust him. I know that non-Christians say, that's too simplistic. If you're in the middle of this kind of Job-type suffering, you're going to ask questions, you're going to want answers, but the book actually says to us at the end of the day, no, what you really need in a suffering time is trust. Ask your questions, find out your answers, get your theories before you start to suffer or once the suffering's over. But in the middle of the suffering, you don't need this profound, clever debate. You just need a loving, listening compassion. And the ability to say, God, I trust you. I can't see where this came from, but I trust you. I can't see how it's going to end, but I trust you. I don't know what your purpose in this is, but I trust you. And ultimately, that's the message of the whole Bible, isn't it? Not saying to us, if you're good enough or spiritual enough or clever enough, you'll get all the answers. But it says to us, if you understand God, you'll know you can trust him with the things you don't understand, with the struggles that are part and parcel of life.